This is Mountain News and World Report, WMMT's weekly sojourn into life in Central Appalachia. We now invite you to join us for a visit with folks you may or may not know, items of interest to us all, and shining moments in our living history.
Hello and welcome to Mountain News. I'm your host, Rachel Geringer. In this episode, we bring you stories of sickness and health in Appalachia. First, from WMMT's own Ohio Valley Resource reporter, Sydney Bowles, we'll hear from widows of miners with black lung about how effects of the deadly disease are rippling out into the broader community. Then, also from OVR, we'll learn about a vaping company that in marketing products to teenagers is creating a major health risk for youth. While the first two stories focus on challenges to health in the region, we'll finish this episode on a positive note with the second in a six-part series from Michael and Carrie Klein. In this edition, Fayetteville, West Virginia residents Bernice Clayton and Nathan Shelton describe their older family members' ability to make do from scratch with local and healthy homegrown foods. On Tuesday, January 22nd, PBS Frontline aired an NPR investigation of the resurgence of black lung disease in Appalachia. Black lung sickens and kills coal miners, but as Sydney Bowles reports, the disease also has much broader effects. Bowles gathered stories from women whose husbands worked in coal and who died from what the widows believe was black lung. But winning benefits from a federal program became a years-long fight.
Vicky Salyers remembers scrubbing black soot from her husband's work clothes.
When he came home, I mean, the only thing you could see would be like the whites of his eyes or his teeth.
Nancy Potter says her husband didn't want to admit he was sick.
I said, can you breathe good? Is walking hard? Or he said, I'll be all right. I'll be all right.
Like generations of women before them, Salyers and Potter sent their husbands off to work in the region's coal mines. And like generations of women before them, they watched their husband's health deteriorate.
He would cough up this black goo.
He got tired real easy.
And then he'd just stay sick all the time, and they'd tell us that it was bronchitis. You know, they treated him for bronchitis for like 3 years.
It even got to the point, you know, we had to raise the head of her bed and put bricks under it so it would get him, raise his head up.
I miss him more than anybody will ever realize. I would not ever wish him back to suffer like he did.
Salyer's husband Eugene died in 2013. Potter lost her husband in 1997. Both women sought federal black lung benefits through the Department of Labor. Their experiences show how a system designed to help provide for coal mining families became a complicated and fraught bureaucracy.
The black lung benefits process is highly adversarial.
That's Evan Smith, an attorney who represents miners and widows in black lung benefits cases.
For people who just file a claim and kind of think they can figure out the system on their own, you know, sadly, they're really at a disadvantage.
For many women, the fight lasts for years. Nancy Potter's fight has lasted 22 years.
It is very, very tiresome.
Nancy and Rich Potter had the kind of marriage that made other couples jealous. He took her on spontaneous trips. She wore her Daisy Dukes just for him. Rich died of a heart attack after decades of coal employment. Potter filed a widow's claim right after Rich passed away.
They kept just turning me down, you know, turning me down. So, and every year I try to do something to keep it going because I'm sorry. But I've just tried every year to do it, and I always thought, you know, I'm going to get it any time. I know he had black lung, and they know he had black lung. But he died with a heart attack, and they said he'd had nothing to do with black lung. And I said, how can that be? Because if you have it, it puts an undue burden on you, on his heart.
A benefits review board found in 2009 that Potter had been denied due process rights, and her claim from 1997 was still viable. She pursued that claim and was denied. Potter has sent her story to the Department of Labor's Inspector General for review. The case is still pending.
I had faith they'd do the right thing, you know. They'd do the right thing. He had black lung, but they're not doing the right thing. I don't know that I'll get it, that someone will see it and say, what is wrong with the system? It's due him, and I'm going to stay with it and fight it to the day I die.
Vicki Salyer's trailer is up a steep driveway in rural Rush, Kentucky. While we spoke, she sat in the chair where her husband used to sit before he got sick. Salyer's and her husband, Gene, never had much money, but in 2002, they bought their trailer brand new.
First new thing we'd ever had. Our first year in this trailer, he bought me a new crock pot and a new sweeper. And I guess I'll remember that forever. I guess because we got a new house, he thought I needed a new sweeper to go with it. But he was so proud of this trailer.
In addition to having several other lung diseases, Gene was diagnosed with lung cancer in 2009 on Christmas Eve.
And the doctor come in and he said, there's no easy way to tell you this, but you got lung cancer. And we fear you might live 6 weeks. But he fought for 5 years. He had several major operations. He had one of his lungs removed. They had to open him up. And this whole side was left open. And I had to dress it every day. It was open for about 4 years. He couldn't hardly eat anything. He couldn't breathe. He would just gasp. He says, are you ready? And I said, where are we going, honey? He said, well, we're going to heaven. And I told him, I said, I can't. One of us has to stay here with Zach and take care of him and Riley. I said, we both can't leave him. And he died at 10:10 that night. You have that one person in your life that you love with your whole heart. And he was mine.
In her grief, Salyer struggled to keep up with her husband's black lung benefits claim.
They'd ask you all these questions, and you're like, you know, hello, I'm country. I don't know this stuff, okay?
But Salyer's filled out the forms. She went to court, and at the district director level, she won. Gene's employer appealed the case to an administrative law judge.
The company, the coal company, had, like, so many days to appeal it. Here's what they do. They wait till that last day. You know, you get excited a little bit. And then they wait to that last day and they appeal it. And then starts the process over again. And that went on for like 2 years, I bet you, or longer.
Salyer's case went all the way to the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Of the roughly 7,000 black lung cases filed each year, only 50 or so reached this level. Finally, in October 2018, she won. She was awarded $48,000. But the money hasn't come.
I know it don't mean nothing to them, but I'm about to lose the only thing that me and my husband had together, because I have to struggle every day to decide, am I going to pay the electric bill this month and the water bill, or do I pay the trailer payment this month? You know, it's not an option. They don't know what it's like to struggle like that. They don't have a clue. If they had to sit here and see him die, they would not put people through that. They wouldn't. They would just give them the benefits and just say, you know, it was deserved.
Salyer's is behind on her trailer payments. Unless the money comes soon, she'll lose her home. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Sydney Bowles in Whitesburg, Kentucky.
Next, from Ohio Valley Resource reporter Mary Meehan, we bring you a story about officials who are warning that a small vaping device called Juul is proving to be a major health risk to youth.
The U.S. Surgeon General says teen vaping has become a major health problem, and a small device called the Juul is at the center of the issue. The Juul is already the vaping tool of choice for many teens. As Mary Meehan reports, health advocates warn that Juul's recent merger with a tobacco giant could put more young people at risk of nicotine addiction.
A slender black rectangle, the jewel fits easily in the palm of your hand. You don't light it, you trigger it with the flick of a finger. The mist that is exhaled is so fine, it's hard to see. A group of students from Casey County, Kentucky affirms those features make jeweling, and yes, it has become a verb, rampant in class.
Yes.
Casey County student Hannah McCreary is a part of an anti-smoking club at her high school. Still, she says, she was surprised when a classmate started puffing quietly into the sleeve of his hoodie.
And right next to me, you know, a boy pulled out this, what I thought was a USB drive, because it looked black and it was small like that, and he had it in his hand and he put it up to his mouth.
According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, teen use is exploding. There was a 78% increase between 2016 and 2017. It is a compounding health risk in the Ohio Valley, where tobacco use is already high. The CDC says about 14% of teens across the country use e-cigarettes.
And so when young people are exposed to the chemicals that are in e-cigarettes, specifically and especially the nicotine, it actually affects the way their brain continues to develop.
That's Angela Brumley Shelton, tobacco coordinator for the Lexington-Fayette County Health Department in Central Kentucky. She says the risks of early exposure are not well understood.
And that has lifelong consequences, and that's something that we're just now beginning to talk about.
Brumley Shelton says many kids and parents consider e-cigarettes harmless and may not even think they contain nicotine, which is highly addictive. And she says the methods used to help people quit the kind of cigarettes you light with a match don't seem to work well on e-cigarette users.
Our old tricks for combustible cigarettes, they don't work for e-cigarettes. So we're worried.
But as health advocates look for ways to keep kids from vaping, they could be facing a huge new challenge. Altria, a giant in the tobacco market, recently purchased 35% of Juul. That partnership brings big money for advertising and political lobbying. Director of Kentucky Youth Advocates Terry Brooks says tobacco ad spending has already helped e-cig use skyrocket.
Nationally, when advertising goes from $3.6 million in 2010 to over $125 million in 2014, those dollars are being well spent.
Brooks says key decisions will be made by state legislators and local governments. And he says health advocates are ready to take on the tobacco lobbyists.
Because there's nothing that we like to tackle better than out-of-state money and people who can't say y'all.
In a video statement, Juul CEO Kevin Burns says Juul is not targeting kids with flavors like mango and mint.
Our intent was never to have youth use Juul, but they are. As the industry leader, we must lead the category in decreasing underage use.
Brooks is skeptical.
Why in the world would you focus on those kind of flavors if it was not intended to specifically target 7th graders?
Brooks isn't the only one with doubts. It's been reported that Food and Drug Administration officials are concerned that the Altria purchase is a way to skirt restricted access to young users. Brooks says that by enticing younger users, companies are trying to create customers who will use their product for life. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Mary Meehan.
Last in this episode of Mountain News, we bring you the second in a 6-part series of short audio documentaries from Michael and Carrie Klein with Talking Across the Lines, LLC. Hope Shorts explore wit and wisdom on race, class, and community survival from Mount Hope, West Virginia. In this second segment, Homegrown, Made from Scratch, Preserved to Last, Bernice Clayton and Nathan Shelton of Fayette County, West Virginia, describe their older family members' ability to make do from scratch, getting by with a dose of humor and a pound of know-how.
Do you want pizza? Do you want to be right? Do you want love? Do you want to fight? Do you want to celebrate? Or would you rather have an altercation? Do you want to build?
And now, Hope, wit and wisdom on race, class, and community survival, brought to you by Talking Across the Lines, the Mountain of Hope organization in Mount Hope, West Virginia, and by the West Virginia Humanities Council. Here we are again at the corner of race and class, watching the world go by and listening for commonality among coalfield voices. Remember Bernice Clayton? She's the Mount Hope mother in our first episode who testified that her children eagerly played with others in the neighborhood, irrespective of the color of their skin. In her own childhood of the 1930s, she took inspiration from the independent spirit of her grandfather.
I was born right here in Fayette County at a little place, Scarborough, West Virginia, and it was called Plum Orchard Road. Most people would tell you there are no black people living on Plum Orchard Road, but my grandpa, Andrew Jackson Lewis, had a farm. He was from Virginia. He settled up there in a tent in 1920. Something about the mines here in Mount Hope, they were put out of their homes, some of the miners.
Mr. Lewis squatted on some land near Scarborough and pitched a tent after being evicted from a company home in 1920 while the miners were organizing the union. His eviction was one of many that led up to the March on Blair Mountain in 1921 in Logan County.
So he went up there and started in a tent, then built his place. So I was born there in 1932. The doctor came on a horse, they tell me.
Mr. Lewis later acquired the place where he had pitched his tent and began to plant fruit trees and plow out a big garden. His survival skills and wide knowledge of plants and seasons provided a model of inventive makeshift living.
It's corn in the crib and apples in the bin, gone, gonna rise again.
My grandpa squatted up there for many years, and then he was able to buy the place where I was born, and it was called a Plum Orchard Road. Then he lost it through taxes, and then he squatted again. Yes, he was a good guy sometime. But he farmed, and he worked in the coal mines. And he preached on the side. Apparently he was a pastor before I was born, but when I knew him, he didn't speak.
Nathan Shelton from Sun grew up in a racially segregated camp where African American culture and tradition centered on communal child rearing and the willingness to share work and food among neighbors.
I was raised in Sun, West Virginia, which is a coal mining camp about 3 miles outside of Mount Hope. Come from a very large family. It was 13 of us. My dad was a coal miner, which most people were back in that time.
The inventive Shelton parents were challenged to feed a family of 15. His mother made her own soap out of lard and lye, and the shirts on their backs were cast-offs his father found in town.
And in Sun, everybody had a garden. You'd raise the hogs and chickens. And I'd go out to the hen house if you wanted some eggs. You know what a fresh egg is. Fresh egg is when you go to the hen house and reach under the hen and get an egg that she just laid.
Well, down in the hen house on my knees, I thought I heard a chicken sneeze. Only my rooster saying his prayers, giving out hymns to the hens upstairs.
Bernice's grandfather not only grew but preserved just about everything on his hillside farm.
My grandpa grew sorghum cane. He had corn, all kinds of fruits, all kinds of vegetables, and he harvested those. He would make a hole in the ground and put straw, and he would take a whole head of cabbage, pull it up by the root, and put it in there, rutabagas, potatoes, all of that, and cover them up. And then in the winter, he'd go out and get them, and the cabbages were just, like, fresh. With the sorghum he grew, he made syrup, molasses. When I was a little girl, he made that. He had to borrow a neighbor's donkey, and they put up the big pan, and they would put the cane in there and turn the donkey around, squeeze the juice out, and then you stirred it, and you took the foam off, and it was sort of green. As it cooked, it turned, you know, black strap, and then he put it in jars and sold it. One time he was a bootlegger, he told me. He made moonshine. He said he'd serve it to the revenuers when they came up. And then they'd take him to jail, and he would cook at Fayetteville, at the jail. And in the morning after he fixed the breakfast and got ready for the lunch, he'd walk through the woods up on the hill home, go back at night. That was the story that was told to me. He was not a real educated man, but he was knowledgeable. And he grew everything on that farm. My kids don't even know what a gooseberry is. But my grandma made gooseberry pies. I wouldn't like to see one, maybe eat one, but I ate so many as a child. Same thing with the molasses. She made gingerbread. We put it on biscuits. Oh, we had it, and I loved it. I wouldn't give you a nickel for some now. I ate so much of it, it was too much for me.
My mother used to make soap out of pork grease and put lye. I don't know what else went in that, but it stunk like crazy. But she'd make soap.
The Shelton family chores were a litany of sweat and toil.
Just surviving. You know, you had to cut wood and carry coal. And then son, water. To carry water. We had no running water. You know, you always had chores. There was always something to do. So you learned how to work. You know, you had to learn how to do physical work. We were poor. My dad would come home with a box of clothes that somebody had given him that, you know, and we'd all be going through the box, see what we could wear. The only thing we'd get new was a pair of new shoes at the beginning of the school year. And that's it.
He worked on his farm, and then he went to work in the mines.
These apple trees on the mountainside gone, gonna rise again. He planted the seeds just before he died gone, gonna rise again. I guess he knew that he'd never see the red fruit hanging from the tree. But he planted the seeds for his children and me, gone, gonna rise again.
My grandpa died when he was 100 years old, and that year he died, he planted tomatoes, just tomatoes. And, of course, we harvested some. He had told us years ago, wrap them in some newspaper, put them in a dark place, and they will ripen. So the year after he died, we had tomatoes at Thanksgiving that we took out of the garden where he planted. You know, we had good things to say and laugh about and to talk about him.
I remember the year that my granddaddy died, gone, gonna rise again. And they dug his grave on the mountainside, gone, gonna rise again. I was too young to understand the way he felt about the land. But I could read his history in his hands, gone, gonna rise again.
You've been listening to the voices of Bernice Clayton and Nathan Shelton sharing family stories of surviving with grace and dignity through tough times, from the period of the mine wars in the 1920s to the decline of the coal industry in the 1950s and 60s. Our Hope theme song, Do You Want Peace, was composed and sung by Laura Sandage and friends on her Bloom CD. John Henry was performed by Sparky Rucker and John Davis on their CD, Heroes and Hard Times. Gone, Gonna Rise Again was written and performed by Cy Kahn, and Leonard and Jim Stonecker played Who Broke the Lock on the Hen House Door. This program was written and produced by Talking Across the Lines, with direction by the Mountain of Hope Organization in Mount Hope, West Virginia. This project is presented with financial assistance from the West Virginia Humanities Council, a state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations do not necessarily represent those of the West Virginia Humanities Council or the National Endowment for the Humanities. For Hope, I'm Carrie Klein.
High on the ridge above the farm, gone, gonna rise again. I think of my people that have gone on, gone, gonna rise again. Like a tree that grows in the mountain ground, the storms of life have cut them down. But the new wood springs from the roots underground, gone, gonna rise again, gone, gonna rise again.
That's it for this episode of Mountain News. If you'd like to hear this or previous episodes again, you can find them on our website at wmmt.org or download Mountain News from SoundCloud or Stitcher. Music on this episode features Buell Kazee with a tune called Short Life of Trouble from Appleshop's own June Apple Recordings. I've been your host, Rachel Geringer, and from all of us at WMMT, thanks for listening to Real People Radio.
I see my coffin coming. The crowd is standing round. Go take me to some lonesome graveyard and let the grave be my home. And when I'm dead and buried, will you come stroll some flowers to show the people around about you the heart you broken lies there?
This has been Mountain News and World Report, a production of WMMT-FM, Mountain Community Public Radio, the non-commercial broadcast service of the world-famous Apple Shop in Whitesburg, Kentucky.